This is the sound of a blazing hot steamer firing away at a tiny pest.
They are everywhere on this couch. There's a seam right there. We'll just go ahead and steam along that seam.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I'm Tanya English.
I'm Alana Gordon.
I'm Zach Seward.
I'm Elizabeth Perez Luna.
I'm Jeanette Woods.
And I'm Mike and Scott. The Pulse takes you on trips with visiting nurses and sometimes on a trip back in time to understand the latest treatments and research studies.
You can think of your genome as a piano.
Being blind from birth, I had to actually learn to think like a sighted person.
Really, the most important thing to make this a success is that the primary care providers have to buy into it.
Always maintain hope.
Fear is woven into the daily existence of medicine.
Neutrinos are some of the fundamental
particles. To see that in the arc of a career is...
They literally had to teach him, like, what a pencil was.
All right, you see the gene gap.
I may get
frustrated.
Slow down the rate at which water temperatures are increasing.
On today's show, does cancer have a smell and could we detect it? And a former Philadelphia Eagle gets candid about the health impact of playing football. But first, back to that steamer, which is aimed at an especially disgusting pest.
In the cities, in our houses, bedbugs have found a place to live.
Well, Isabella Rossellini can make anything sound beautiful.
They could hide any place in our apartments, but the place they love best is our beds.
Are they in your bed? Bedbugs are making a comeback in cities like Philadelphia, and they are freaking people out.
I looked down and I was like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, it's a bedbug, it's a bedbug.
Calm down. It's a bad name they gave them.
Their scientific name is Cymex lectularius. Bedbugs are tiny, often burgundy-colored creatures. Some entomologists find their ability to evolve with humans fascinating. Experts battling these bugs are looking to the past and south of the border for solutions. Alana Gordon reports.
Mackenzie McAlpin is totally freaked out by bedbugs.
I think I have a bedbug phobia. I'm a little bit wildly scared of them.
When she was a kid, she'd heard the old rhyme, you know, sleep tight, don't let the bed bugs bite.
My mom always said it forever, but like, they're real. they're a real thing. Ugh.
Yep, bed bugs are real. Six-legged insects that feed off human blood at night. So you can't blame McAlpin for wanting to avoid them. Though her precautions might not be that practical.
You know, I'm the one friend that crosses the street when we're walking past a bed, and I'm like, ooh, get away. You know, I don't know. I don't know what's on it. I don't want to know. I don't need to know. Get me away.
Paranoid, perhaps. Michael Levy, on the other hand, is a bit obsessed.
The adults are probably the size of a small ant. You can kind of hear them if you put the mic up to the...
Levy is an epidemiologist at the University of Pennsylvania. In his Stark lab, he asks a student to hold up a glass jar filled with hundreds of light brown bedbugs crawling on sheets of paper.
They sense the CO2 in her breath. You can see they got very excited. Now they're crawling up and down the paper.
Levy's bedbug fascination can be traced to time he spent over the past decade in Latin America, where he met an insect called the kissing bug.
And it's kind of like a giant, horrible cousin of the bedbug.
Like bedbugs, kissing bugs feed on blood at night. Unlike bedbugs, some of them can transmit a parasite to humans that can damage the heart, among other things.
And I was terrified, so every night I'd have my flashlight and I'd check my room to make sure there were none of these bugs, and slowly that fear became interest.
Levy has been working to wipe out the disease in parts of Peru through an ongoing door-to-door extermination effort. Though bedbugs pose less of a threat up here, they do exact an emotional and economic toll. So, inspired by Peru's model, Levy is now leading door-to-door specimen hunts and household surveys in parts of Philly. Levy says people like McAlpin do have some cause for worry. Bedbug complaints are steadily rising. A lot of people have them, he says, but not a lot of people are talking about it.
Nursing homes are suffering, institutions are suffering, hospitals are suffering, universities are suffering, and everyone kind of quietly deals with it, but this is all very discreet.
There's the stigma that only poor, dirty people get bedbugs. Not true. What is true is that those who are better off can better afford to fight an infestation. Exterminators alone can cost more than $1,000. The city doesn't treat bedbugs as a public health threat, so the onus is on individuals.
These are the protected bed mattress encasements. We're bringing lots of little goodies in.
Robert DeJoseph and Jeff White are part of a $1 million Battle the Bedbug business. They recently responded to a call from a suburban Philadelphia row home. The resident applied to their charitable program for help.
I always had it in my head that it could be, but I always was trying to push it to the back because I didn't want it to be.
So I'm wondering if you can introduce yourself.
Yeah, I'd just rather, you know, not say my name just because of the perceptions.
He says living with the itchy threat of bedbug bites has been emotionally devastating.
I mean, you know when you go to sleep you're going to be getting bit. You feel helpless because you're kids. There were nights when I came downstairs and cried.
They're everywhere on this couch.
White takes a steamer to the couch. Heat is a key weapon against bedbugs. In the bedroom, White and DeJoseph pull the bedding off a mattress.
It's common to find bedbugs in the bedding, especially where it's tucked into the foot of the bed, because it's never bothered. Bedbugs want to be in areas of least disruption first.
The two flip a box spring upright against the wall. They spy a quarter-inch dot. A freshly fed bed bug.
When they're not fed, they're flat, they're paper thin. That one, if you look at it closely, is all engorged with blood.
White says he's never brought bed bugs home from work. Then again, he knows not to sit down anywhere while on the job. Bed bugs may not be quick to leave a bed, but they may hitch rides on people's stuff. White says responding early can blunt an infestation, but left to themselves, bed bugs can spread around a building or even a neighborhood. Bedbugs aren't a new problem. Don Buehler, a professor at the University of Maryland, studies the history of urban pests. She says bedbugs were common in the U.S. up to the 40s and 50s.
It was almost kind of an accepted condition of urban life.
So true, say some longtime Philadelphia residents. Phyllis Navo.
When I was a little girl, my mother used to open the windows, take the sheets and mattress off the bed. And she used to have a bat, and she used to bang the springs with the bat so all the bed bugs could fall out of the springs. Something
was moaning. John Rodrigo.
We had a lot of bed bugs in them days.
Yeah, in Philadelphia.
Our parents would use some kind of a spray they put on the bed, and it stunk.
We'd put wax candles and burn the bed bugs out like that there. Mother bed bug
ran to the that was Eileen Ashton. So what curbs the bed bug? Don Buehler says DDT and other powerful pesticides, plus people's vigilance. But now in a familiar tale of modern science, bed bugs have evolved and developed resistance to chemicals.
And then you eventually end up with bed bugs that resist anything you throw at them.
Buehler says bed bugs are widespread again, but there are some ways to combat them beyond chemicals. She suggests reducing clutter, being careful about what goes in and out of the home, hot water laundering, and that's the sound of Mackenzie McAlpin, the Philadelphia woman trying to keep her apartment safe from bedbugs.
Like creases.
But bedbugs can outwit even the vigilant. About 9 months ago, McAlpin returned one evening after hanging out with friends.
And I get home and I sit down on my bed to text message somebody. And something caught the corner of my eye. I was like, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god, it's a bed bug, it's a bed bug. And I grabbed a tissue and I squeezed it and like, ugh, you know, like so hard squeezed it because I just wanted to know that it was dead. It happened. Okay, it happened. I knew this was going to happen. It happened.
She called her landlord's exterminator, Steve Realdean.
How may I help you?
You know, and I was like, look, calm down. It's a bad name they gave them.
At Realdean's direction, McAlpin prepped her apartment, washing sheets and clothes, emptying drawers and nightstands. He came over to inspect.
I didn't find anything.
Strangely enough for McAlpin, finally coming face to face with her fear might have been a good thing.
One thing that it taught me, this scare, is that I can't do anything about it. I'm either going to constantly live in fear or I'm just going to, like, roll with it be conscious of my surroundings and know that it happens to everybody.
Even though bedbugs don't transmit disease, Dawn Beeler says the shame and mental stress are still problems. And sometimes people actually do themselves harm while battling the bugs using toxic or flammable chemicals.
Are we going to become more open about the issue? Are we going to kind of remove the stigma and be able to talk about bedbugs openly so that we can get help to the people who need it?
Meanwhile, Michael Levy, the Penn entomologist, plans to pound on more doors, starting in South Philly this summer. He wants to figure out all the bedbug tricks for moving from place to place in case bedbugs become a source of disease. So all you folks south of South Street, don't be alarmed if someday you see a mild-mannered guy knocking at your door, ready to ask about bedbugs in your home. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Are you itching all over now, worried that you have bedbugs? Fear not. Go to our website, whyy.org/thepulse, check out what these things look like, and advice for getting rid of them. Concerns about climate change often focus on melting ice, receding glaciers, polar bears losing their frosty habitats, and our winters seem to be getting warmer, the recent cold snaps notwithstanding. A national project is collecting data to quantify those changes. IceWatch USA is enlisting citizen scientists to measure ice over the course of the winter. It's one of the projects listed on the SciStarter website that connects people with science projects they can do in their spare time. Kimberly Haas has this story.
The volunteer ice watchers first select a body of water that's accessible to them during the winter. It could be a lake, a pond, or a stream. They collect data at that site, which is then crunched and analyzed by scientists who study climate change and other environmental issues.
I go out to Ridley Creek State Park, which is not too far from where I live.
Bob Burke is an ice watch volunteer in Delaware County. He's a lively septuagenarian, retired and now living a life, in his words, of serial volunteerism.
So we're standing at the falls at Ridley Creek State Park. There's a small island in the middle. Last week, the falls were frozen. We measure the ice from the shore to the island. You know, visually, with your eyes, good. But the best thing is photos. You get a quick view and you don't stand and freeze to death.
Bob takes out a clipboard and writes down some notes, estimating the amount of ice between the island and the shore.
And we observe and we take these readings, record the date, the time, air temperature, location, latitude and longitude.
Volunteers also track all types of wildlife and waterfowl at their site during the winter. The project launched in 2008 and has grown to include ice watchers in 48 states, all but Hawaii and Alabama. The upcoming 5-year anniversary is significant for the usefulness of the data, says Melinda Hughes-Wirt, the program's director.
You need a little bit longer period of time to really see what's going on because it fluctuates so much with the winter season and the temperatures and the jet streams coming down from the Arctic and, you know, you get the nor'easters coming up the coast. And so you have a lot of variances that you don't have regularly throughout the year.
Though IceWatch is very specific in its goals, it actually has a broader reach when the data it's gathered join with other projects. Darlene Cavalier is the founder of the citizen science website, SciStarter.
So we can look at something as finite as Ice Watch or projects that ask people to measure precipitation, rain, snow, hail. It seems very limited in what you're being asked to do, but the fact is many of these projects feed into larger projects.
To that end, Ice Watch is part of the National Phenology Network, a group of scientists who study life cycle events in animal and plant species, like when waterfowl migrate or when a tree's leaves fall, and how they're affected by environmental changes. Melinda Hughes-Wirt says one goal is to standardize methods of collecting and tabulating data to facilitate sharing.
We're working on making sure that all the volunteers across the board have similar ways of entering data, so the information from different groups can be used together to analyze climate change and other environmental indicators.
Besides Bob Burke with Ridley Creek in Delaware County, IceWatch USA also has volunteers watching Mill Creek in Bucks County, and the Millstone River near Princeton. Philadelphia-area bodies of water on their wish list include the Schuylkill River, Brandywine Creek, and the Mullica River. For The Pulse, I'm Kimberly Haas.
Do you want to participate in this project or do another science project? We're partnering up with SciStarter to keep you posted on interesting opportunities like that in our region. Go to our website, whyy.org/thepulse, for details. Coming up on The Pulse, dogs can sniff bombs, they can rescue survivors, but can they detect cancer?
He sniffed the samples, and when he put his nose on the one that had the cancer samples, he sat. And that's exactly what we want him to do.
We'll meet the next generation of super dogs. That's coming up on The Pulse.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is committed to building healthier, more vibrant communities through disease education and awareness initiatives, access to affordable medicines, and partnerships with nonprofit organizations across the Philadelphia region and beyond. Last year, AstraZeneca donated more than $6.7 million to nonprofit organizations for programs and projects aimed at improving health across the U.S. Learn more at AstraZeneca-US.com.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, instead of freezing in fear, Deborah Cohen danced before her double mastectomy.
I made the video for myself so that I would be able to watch myself dancing after surgery.
Now that video is part of a major ad. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. When dogs go to work, their office doesn't have cubicles.
We have a bright blue matted floor so the dogs can work on that floor without causing injury or slipping too much.
That's Dr. Cindy Otto. She's a veterinarian who directs the Penn Vet Working Dog Center in West Philadelphia. Dogs there train all day for future jobs in search and rescue, to sniff out bombs, and several of the dogs are going to be working in the medical field.
Currently, we're really focusing on two different things. One is cancer detection, specifically ovarian cancer, and then the second is diabetic alert dogs. And these are very different jobs. The diabetic alert dog will be paired with a diabetic individual, and they will specifically alert that person when their blood sugar is too high or too low. So that dog becomes the partner to the individual. Whereas our cancer detection dogs are very much removed from people. They work in an isolated environment in that they work in a laboratory, and samples are brought into them, and they are then screening those samples to tell whether or not there's evidence of the odor associated with ovarian cancer.
In the lab, five clear containers are lined up against the wall. A young Springer Spaniel named McBain comes in. His mission? Find the one sample that has cancer cells in it.
Good job, bud. Come here, Beanie. Oh, you got
it. So what did he just do?
So just now he went through, the first time he was just still a little too distracted, so we pulled him back and had him start over, and then he sniffed the samples, and when he put his nose on the one that had the cancer samples, he sat. And that's exactly what we want him to do.
Good job. Here.
Back in her office, Dr. Otto explains that the dogs are helping them detect if ovarian cancer has a smell, which could eventually lead to the development of an artificial nose, or e-nose, that would sniff out cancer in samples at a much larger scale and at a lower cost. So it could mean an inexpensive way to screen for ovarian cancer.
Because we know the dogs have a better sense of smell and ability to differentiate the confounding odors. So we think the dogs are going to help make a test that is going to be more widely available.
Can the dog detect something that a scientist couldn't see under a microscope, or can the dog do something that a person cannot?
Based on all the evidence, yes, we think that the dog's sensitivity, not only in his nose and ability to pick up very low levels, but again, to filter out all of the miscellaneous smells that when the scientists look at it, they look at it and they look at the chemical signature using gas chromatography and mass spectrometry, and they try to separate out these chemicals into their individual components. And when you're talking of hundreds of thousands of chemicals in a sample, it's really hard to parse that out. And so the dogs almost act like a sieve to help us figure out, is it this group of chemicals versus that group of chemicals? And that's what we're going to be working with the chemist to try and help them narrow down the focus, because the dogs can do that naturally because they're using their brain as well as their nose.
And what is the sample made of that you're using in the cancer detection?
So for our initial training, we're using actual ovarian cancer samples, so tissue that's been taken from patients that had ovarian cancer. And so we're teaching the dogs to recognize the smell of ovarian cancer. The next step, though, is to move to plasma samples, so blood samples that have been collected from these patients, and comparing those to patients that have ovarian disease, but it's not cancerous, and then comparing those to control patients. And so trying to get those dogs to recognize what it is that's very unique and only in the samples with ovarian cancer.
If I'm a person getting screened for cancer, what might that look like in 5-10 years? If this research is successful?
Right now, our focus, again, is on ovarian cancer. We believe that different cancers are going to have different odors. Certainly, 10 years down the line, maybe we'll find something that's common in all cancers. That would be wonderful, but probably not as logical, given that cancers are so different from different tissues. For ovarian cancer, our ultimate goal would be that a person could even collect a urine sample and ship it off every 6 months to be screened.
There seems to be a lot of excitement about this work. Do you think that's because we are, for the most part, a very dog-loving society, or is it something that these dogs bring that is fascinating to people?
I think there's so many levels that it's exciting. The capability of what dogs bring to us is endless. And part of it is because they can communicate things to us that we just don't understand but enrich our lives. And then this becomes a tangible thing that they can communicate and save people's lives.
And how do you look at these dogs? What do you think when you see them? What's your relationship like?
I love these dogs. I get shivers sometimes when I watch them work and when I watch how fabulous they are, and I'm very invested. They are kind of like my children, my students, and to watch them succeed is everything that I'm looking for. And I expect them to be superstars, and every so often when one doesn't perform perfectly, I'm like, oh no, and then I look back and I realize where they are and how much they actually have made that progress, and that they still are, all of our dogs are still so young in their training, and they're so exceptional.
Dr. Cindy Otto is a veterinarian, and she heads the Penn Vet Working Dog Center. When the dogs are done with their long workday, they go home to foster families. So what's it like to care for a super dog? A dog that costs about $36,000 a year to train. Larry Roebling has personal experience, and she has this story.
Olin, leave it. Leave it. Good boy, Olin.
Olin is a wonderful 16-month-old chocolate lab.
Yes.
And I have what you might call shared custody of him in his spare time. Olin's main foster mom is Jean Finley, and I take Olin home when she's got other life commitments. And much like two custodial parents, we sit down together and talk about how our pooch is doing in his training, what behaviors need reinforcement, changes in diet, and good reports from his trainers.
Anything I should be doing at home with him, or just we continue to do the foundation of the obedience and helping him stay focused.
The main fosters devote enormous time and attention to the dogs. They make sure they're at the Penn Vet Working Dog Center for their full day of training Monday through Friday. Fosters have the dogs at home nights and weekends. And because the dogs start as young pups, that includes some sleepless nights early on. But for all the serious nature of the work, these are puppies who also bring fun and games, says Jean Finley.
he is definitely a social guy. And when I'm at home and he hears my doorbell ring, he will come running from wherever he is in the house. So sometimes, just for fun, I will know he's upstairs and I ring the doorbell and he comes bolting down the stairs like we have company. And then he looks up and he sees me.
Olin got the last laugh on me recently when we were in the car and he was safely in his car crate until we hit a Philly pothole and I heard the door go. You could see the bubble above my head. Holy sh**. And the one above Olin's. In addition to the laughs, like all family pets, the dogs bring something intangible. Dr. Gia Croce is a veterinarian, and she fosters Kaiserin, a female Dutch shepherd.
Most surprising has been the way she sort of relates to our son, who has special needs. They're both very high energy. She's so non-reactive. It's really brought us together in many ways. My husband and I have to work together, and she's been great. She's really amazing with our son.
Another dog foster parent, Clint Kuban, says his dog Tsunami helps with much-needed work-life balance.
The bond that you develop with the dogs, really, it hits home. And after a long day of studying, you know, I'm a veterinary student at Penn Vet. I'm a second year, and that's very, very difficult. So being able to come home and enjoy a nice, relaxed dog who spent all day detecting ovarian cancer and running on rubble piles, can sit down and really get that love and best friend that I need.
Deep and loving as these relationships are, all fosters know that one day their charge will leave and go on to a full-time career saving lives. Kathy von Elm fosters Ronnie, a German shepherd who will be leaving soon for duty in police work.
I never thought that he was my dog, and as I got to know him, I realized that he's kind of everybody's dog. I love sharing him with people, and it's been a huge privilege to have him. But I really do think he belongs to something bigger than just my little house.
And it's that final bittersweet moment when the dogs move on to their life-saving careers that is the real reward for the foster families. For now, Olin, the dog I helped take care of, will continue his work at the center in the ovarian cancer detection study. And that means I'll be on the lookout for those car crate-releasing Philly potholes. For The Pulse, I'm Larry Roebling.
Olin is not just extraordinary, he's also very cute. And you can see pictures at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Printers are still relatively new on the scene, but already they are revolutionizing certain aspects of manufacturing, and they are opening new doors. Some researchers think this fast-developing technology could be used to print human organs. Bioengineer Jordan Miller started researching ways to use 3D printing to create human tissue when he was a postdoc at Penn 5 years ago. The technique is called bioprinting. Here's what he does in his own words.
I'm working in the field of 3D printing and bioengineering. Bioengineering, it's kind of an overlap between the field of biology and the field of engineering. So we're trying to apply the design principles of engineering. How do you define the key characteristics of something like a living tissue? And how do you use that to build back up a structure, something that can function like a living tissue found in the body? We've been adapting 3D printing technologies to try to address some of that. 3D printing is really amazing. One of the most interesting parts of 3D printing is that people don't fully know everything it can be used for yet. Every time the printer is operating, it still draws my attention. It's still mesmerizing to me. There's been a lot of interest in the field of bioprinting. So this is the idea of taking cells and 3D printing them, using them as the ink in a 3D printer, where you can build up a structure one layer at a time. And it gives the architect access to every position in a 3D space, in a 3D volume. I came here in 2008 to start a postdoctoral fellowship at University of Pennsylvania. We developed a lot of the modifications for these open source 3D printers to enable our research with living human cells. Some of the early work in regenerative medicine and tissue engineering was making a lot of things like hard metals and plastics that could interface in the body. You can think of like a hip implant or a knee implant, total knee replacement. But there's a lot of functions in the body that cannot be adequately addressed by things like a plastic or a metal. So we don't know how to make a plastic or a metal that can metabolize aspirin or alcohol, for example. Those functions are taken by our cells. The realization in the last several decades in our field has been we're going to need to add cells back into the structures we're implanting in the body to be able to help restore a lot of the function for the more complicated organs. Things more complicated than a knee, where we're just replacing mechanical function, things like people are starting to think about things like the liver or the kidney that have very complex interactions with all of the physiology in the body. And how do we develop strategies that can address that? We don't really know how long it's going to take yet, but the eventual goal is to be able to take a sample of a patient's own cells and be able to make a replacement tissue for them.
Jordan Miller is a bioengineer and co-founder of Hive 76, a shared workspace for inventors, creators, builders, makers here in Philadelphia. He is currently conducting his research at Rice University in Houston, Texas. So Miller's dream is to create organs with a 3D printer, which sounds like it could help alleviate the organ shortage faced by those waiting for transplants. Joining us now is Art Kaplan, a medical ethicist at New York University. Art Kaplan, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what is the promise of this kind of research?
I think this research is very, very exciting, and it holds an enormous amount of promise. When you engineer cells, the problem has been it's hard to get them to go 3D. It's hard to get them to make organs like a heart or even a simple thing like a blood vessel. You can grow sheets of cells pretty easily, but getting them to take a third dimensional form, you got to grow them around plastic things. It's a hassle. If you could print them out the way we print out other objects using these newfangled 3D printers, and then substitute anything from, say, someone who might have a kidney damaged and grow the little tubes in the kidney, you could make not only an enormous dent on organs for transplant, but an enormous dent in the need for replacement parts for all kinds of ailments and disabilities.
What could this mean for people waiting for transplants and for the really complicated system we have right now in place in terms of who gets an organ when?
Huge numbers of people die on the waiting list because there simply aren't enough organs to give them. We're short on kidneys, short on hearts, short on livers, every major vital organ, we don't have enough. Plus, we have to get into enormous battles about who is going to get the scarce organs that do become available. Listeners will remember the fights about Sarah Moynihan, the little girl who needed a lung. There are a lot of people now in their 70s, 80s, and 90s who wouldn't even be considered for a transplant just because everybody knows they're in short supply and those people are likely to do less well. But if you could make organs on demand, you'd see more transplants because we'd try to do transplants on many of them as well.
Do you have any concerns with this kind of engineering of tissues, of organs? Anything that worries you as an ethicist?
I think the biggest concern about engineering these organs is figuring out what the right materials are. We sometimes think, oh, well, they'll be plastic. But no, you may want to make things out of sugars that dissolve or other plant products that might go away. You have some parts of organs that you want to disappear and get replaced by cells growing into them. So the challenge, I think, is the experimentation. From society's point of view and medicine's point of view, you want to make sure it's safe. That's where the tough ethical balance is going to go. Shortage drives huge demand, but safety requires slow, steady examination.
So you won't be out of a job anytime soon.
No, this area, at least in research ethics, it's pretty good for full employment for a while, I would say.
Art Kaplan, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Art Kaplan is a medical ethicist at NYU. Coming up on The Pulse, one man's path from being a medical examiner to smoothing over holes in walls.
I'm always patching up things, trying to fix holes.
gunshot wound holes to hammer holes.
That's coming up on The Pulse.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Thomas Jefferson University's School of Population Health supports WHYY and offers a fully accredited master's degree in public health. An open house will be held at 5:30 p.m. Thursday, January 23rd in the school's offices on the 10th floor of 901 Walnut Street. Registration online at jefferson.edu/openhouse. The Jefferson School of Population Health, bringing health and health care together. Thomas Jefferson University School of Population Health supports WHYY.
Does the NSA need a reboot?
I think so. I think that we're at a point we don't want to handicap our intelligence agencies, but we want to make sure that they have checks and balances.
The New Yorker's Lawrence Wright on the post-Snowden NSA. Does it need adjustment or a complete overhaul? That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse and is committed to building healthier communities through programs and partnerships that increase disease awareness and prevention and provide access to affordable medicines. Learn more at AstraZeneca-US.com.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Now it's time for Patient Files, our series exploring your stories of illness, recovery, and health. This week, 25-year-old filmmaker Scott Clifford talks about living with a rare genetic disorder and not letting a wheelchair slow him down.
I have osteogenesis imperfecta, which is a genetic disorder. It affects the bones, makes them brittle. The plan or however your brain's supposed to make collagen is just defective from the start. It keeps going, like, oh, that's bad bone, let's make some more. It's just going to keep making bad bone. It's not, it's like a vicious cycle. When you break your bones, they heal, obviously, but they don't heal like normally, like a normal person. They tend to not heal straight. Even if you try and realign the bone, it still tends to heal crooked. It doesn't, just because of the way the collagen is. So, for example, I have a really bad bend on my left arm because I broke it a lot when I was younger. If you look at my lower legs, my tibias, they're bent a little bit at the end as well. So if you see me on the street, you'll see, for example, my left arm has a pretty bad bow to it. I have what they call a barrel chest, which just means that the ribs curve out more than a normal person. There are many different types. My type is type 3, which is more severe, but not the most. Knock on whatever you want, I'm still around, so... If I had to do it in one word, I would say I'm a filmmaker. I was busy trying to shoot my junior thesis when my lead actor dropped out, so I had to scramble to find another lead actor. I hadn't slept for, well, I want to say 2 to 3 days, just been doing all the work, and we met up at the library. I say it was because I was tired, but really I was just stupid. Too busy looking at my phone, and I noticed... Oh, I'm falling down a flight of stairs. I didn't look. I was just casually rolling off the stairs. So I fall down pretty much face first onto the ground. Which is, it's funny now, but it wasn't so funny then. The pain wasn't too bad yet because of the adrenaline, but I had a hard time moving. I get in the stretcher, which is always tougher because, you know, when you have a rare condition like I do, you have to really stand up for yourself. To tell them how they need to handle you, because it's not the same as a normal able-bodied person. And so that's a problem a lot of people in my condition have, because you have to be, I don't want to say strong enough, I don't think it's the right word, but strong enough to really stand up for yourself at literally like the worst moment possible, when you don't want to stand up for anything. And then it gets into, well, you know, we giving you like pain medication. I've had so many surgeries throughout the years that, like, morphine doesn't work for me anymore. So I have to convince them that they need to give me something stronger than morphine. And try not to sound like you're just a drug addict looking for a fix. A lot of kids with my condition like to give numbers out. And you see headlines on newspapers going like, kid with, you know, air condition breaks 400 bones in lifetime or 300 bones in lifetime. I don't like to count that because I don't view that as my life. I can't really give you a solid number. I can say that my family told me that they stopped counting when it reached 50 when I was 8. My philosophy for my disability is pretty simple. It's to try and live the life that I want despite the obstacles. Unfortunately, I have a lot more obstacles than most. That's just reality. I'm a person trying to do their best with flaws like everyone else.
Scott Clifford is a filmmaker, and you can read his essay and find links to his videos on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Many of us change careers at some point in our lives, not me, of course, but, you know, sometimes it's a slight course correction, other times a radical move. A Chester County man went from medical examiner to home repair kit inventor to reality show contestant.
This is the Shark Tank, where hopeful entrepreneurs get a once-in-a-lifetime...
Dr. Jim Lewis traded stitching up bodies for pitching his product in front of a group of cutthroat investors, the Sharks. The episode featuring Lewis aired last Friday, and Zach Seward was there for the viewing party.
How many people think I got 4 sharks?
I think you got 2.
Jim Lewis is sworn to secrecy. There's a crowd of family and friends at a law office in a Wilmington high-rise, but only Lewis knows what's about to happen. He's also wearing scrubs and a long white lab coat.
Is this what you wore in the show? Oh, yeah, it's what I wore in the show. See that? The Wall Doctor. Look at that, Harry.
Wall RX is the name of the product. It starts with a plastic disc ranging from 1 to 4 inches in size that you put over a hole in the wall.
And then there's this other, like plastery type stuff, and you peel that off and you stick it over the disc.
You let it sit for a day or two, sand it down.
And then you're done.
So tell me who you are again.
I am Veronica Lane, and I am the wall nurse.
She's the model from the demo video. Lewis is up by a big TV over a long conference table that's covered in sandwich fixings. It's just a few minutes now till his pre-recorded appearance hits the airwaves.
Okay, but I'm still feeling a little nervous now because I'm not sure what they're going to include and what they're going to take out.
The story of Wall Doctor RX all starts about 3 years ago, around Christmas. Lewis was carrying an artificial tree out of the basement when he heard a scream. His daughter had tripped. A minor scrape, but when he rushed upstairs, the tree had fallen and lodged itself into a newly refinished wall.
After my daughter injured her knee, I kind of put the two together. If you can fix skin and you can fix a hole in the leg, then why can't you fix a wall the same way?
It cost over $300 for a handyman to fix it. Lewis says that's when his science background kicked in.
I was trying to create essentially a Band-Aid for a wall.
Lewis is familiar with wounds. He's a longtime forensic pathologist who worked as a medical examiner in Philadelphia and South Jersey.
There's an underbelly in society that most people do not know about. And I would suggest they don't know about. Leave it alone. Live your happy life because it's pretty horrible.
He says he's seen and learned a lot from 18 years on the job. Helping people with their walls isn't medicine, but it's still helping.
I'm always patching up things, trying to fix holes, gunshot wound holes to hammer holes.
It took Lewis just over 400 versions to get it just right, especially the goopy compound that makes it stick.
This is patch number 402. I think it's working, it's working, it's working. It worked. Dear, I don't have to hit any more holes in our garage wall. I've done it.
So he gets a patent. An enthusiastic pitch gets him linked up with a well-connected lawyer, which then gets him a meeting with Lowe's Home Improvement. For the last year, Wall RX has been in every Lowe's in the country. Lewis says 90,000 units have sold, which brings us back to his appearance in front of the cutthroat investors in the Shark Tank.
Okay, back, okay.
The During his 10-minute segment, Lewis did a demonstration.
First, you need a hold.
Drop some numbers.
What is your gross sales?
Our gross sales was $600,000.
And fielded offers from four of the five sharks.
Those are your options. What is your decision?
It looked dicey for a minute, but in the end, Lewis paired off with one investor who put up $150,000 for the foreign rights to Wall RX.
Let's do it.
I'm there. Let's do it. I'm there, man.
Do I hear a yes?
Deal.
Yes.
Did that backfire? What happened?
In this show, there was a lot that they had to cut out. I was in front of the shark for approximately an hour and a half.
Lewis still can't spill the beans on everything that really happened until Shark Tank says he can. There may be another deal, inked off screen, who knows? But if the response so far is any indication, Lewis's leap from the morgue to the business world could be a real breakthrough. For The Pulse, I'm Zach Seward.
The physical impact of playing professional football is in the news again, or did it ever leave? This week, a U.S. district judge rejected the proposed $765 million settlement of NFL concussion claims because she questioned whether it's enough to pay for the health woes of thousands of retired players involved in that suit. A former Eagle quarterback is offering a personal and intimate look at the toll of the game. Mike Barilla played with the Eagles from 1974 to 1976 and played in the Pro Bowl in 1977. And he's written a one-man play about football, concussions, and why he left the NFL at the height of his career. Peter Crimmins reports on the disappearing quarterback.
Mike Barilla played with the Eagles for three seasons. He left after 1976 to play with Tampa Bay for one season, and then he turned his back on football altogether. He became a tax lawyer, then a mortgage banker. He raised four sons. All that time, he never talked about his time on the gridiron.
My oldest son was getting older, and he was starting to ask me about it, because I'd never talked to him about it. There was this movie that came out, Invincible, and in there they have pictures of me getting sacked. They use video. And he goes, Dad, I don't understand. Why did you quit so early?
Greg Gordon rolling out to the right.
You have to look fast to see Barilla's number 10 jersey in the 2006 film Invincible, starring Mark Wahlberg as the rookie Vince Papale. Barilla has not appeared in any football documentaries, any football tributes. He's never been interviewed for highlight reels. When he left, he really left. Football was dead to him.
I was an All-American quarterback at Stanford University.
Barilla's previous life in football is now coming to the stage at Plays and Players Theater in Philadelphia's Rittenhouse Square. At 62 years old, this is the playwright's first production.
And because I was the quarterback, they always had me show around the quarterback recruits.
And that's when you go down to the... bring it down. Yeah.
Okay. That other voice that you're hearing there is Daniel's student. He's the director of the piece, and they're in rehearsal. Barilla lives in Denver, and he cold-called student in Philadelphia to ask if he would produce a musical comedy he had just written called Eagles Belong Where They Can Fly. The first thing student did was Google Mike Barilla's name to find out just who he was. And then he read the script, and honestly, he wasn't that impressed. But he saw potential.
In the script that he sent me, there were these little nuggets, these little paragraphs that he gave to a narrator that seemed to be very personal stories, the kind of thing you couldn't make up about his life in football.
Student kept in a lot of stuff about how Barilla had to have his ankles taped in the locker room before games and how he had to babysit new recruits at Stanford. But he wanted to reimagine the material into a monologue, a 75-minute love letter to football called The Disappearing Quarterback. At 6'3", with hands that could palm a watermelon, Barilla was a natural quarterback, but he never felt entirely comfortable with football.
I had to make a decision about how.
In this part of the play, Barilla recalls a night when a bunch of All-American players were flown to Chicago for a photo session at the Playboy Club. Just as that party started heating up, Barilla made a quick exit.
So I took a cab back to the hotel, and I spent the rest of the evening studying the book of Isaiah alone in my hotel. That's how I pretty much made it through pro football.
Barilla used his faith to navigate his professional football career, and ultimately it was that faith that caused him to leave.
The reason why I left was I felt the Lord was telling me to leave and not look back.
And there was another nagging worry on his mind, his health. Barilla had suffered three serious concussions playing football.
They called a concussion getting dinged.
Dinged.
Dinged. That was the word they used. I remember a coach going, "Mike, it's no big deal. You just got dinged."
Over the past 35 years, Barilla has seen his former teammates and rivals topple from long-term injuries, like chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, Lou Gehrig's disease, a life of 12 hours of constant medical care 7 days a week. Even though Barilla spent just 5 years in the NFL, his director at Plays and Players Theater, Daniel Student, says you can see the damage.
The show is on the third floor of our theater, and we're a historic 102-year-old building without an elevator, so the man walks up and down the steps, and you can see it when he walks up and down the steps.
Barilla was not part of the recent lawsuit many former players brought against the National Football League to address post-traumatic health concerns from years of play. A recent study by Harvard University shows the average lifespan of an NFL player is 55 years. Barilla is now 62.
I am the primary caretaker of my son with Down syndrome. I've been actively involved in raising our four sons. If I had been brutalized by pro football, like so many of these quarterbacks have, I wouldn't be able to raise them. And in a lot of cases, some of the guys I played with are dead, and they died 10 years ago.
This play, The Disappearing Quarterback, opens this weekend. During its run, some of Barilla's former Eagles teammates, Charlie Young and Kevin Riley, will attend a post-performance talk. For The Pulse, I'm Peter Crimmins.
We have a video of Barilla's rehearsal at whyy.org/thepulse. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Zach Seward, and Alana Gordon. Jeanette Woods produced segments for today's show. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, our assistant producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Cetullo is our vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, chief content officer. And we'd really like to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.